Darkly Dreaming Dexter, Disc 2.
There is no starry sky anywhere like the starry sky in South Florida when you are 14 and camping out with Dad. Even if he's only your foster dad. And even if the sight of all those stars merely fills you with a kind of satisfaction, emotion being out of the question, you don't feel it. That's part of the reason you're here. The fire has died down and the stars are exceedingly bright, and foster dear old Dad has been quiet for some time, taking small sips of the old-fashioned hip flask he has pulled from the outside flap of his pack. And he's not very good at this. Not like so many other cops, not really a drinker. But it's empty now, and it's time for him to say his piece, if he's ever going to say it. "You're different, Dexter," he says. I look away from the brightness of the stars, around the small and sandy clearing the last glow of the fire is making shadows. Some of them trickle across Harry's face. He looks strange to me, like I've never seen him before. Determined, unhappy, a little dazed. "What do you mean, Dad?" He won't look at me.
"The Billups say Buddy has disappeared," he says.
"Noisy little creep. He was barking all night. Mom couldn't sleep." Mom needed her sleep, of course. Dying of cancer requires plenty of rest, and she wasn't getting it with that awful little dog across the street yapping at every leaf that blew down the sidewalk.
"I found the grave," Harry says. "There were a lot of bones in there, Dexter. Not just Buddy's."
There's very little to say here. I carefully pull at a handful of pine needles and wait for Harry.
"How long have you been doing this?"
I search Harry's face, then look out across the clearing to the beach. Our boat is there, moving gently with the surge of the water. The lights of Miami are off to the right, a soft white glow. I can't figure out where Harry is going, what he wants to hear. But he is my straight arrow foster dad. The truth is usually a good idea with Harry. He always knows, or he finds out. "A year and a half," I say. Harry nods.
"Why did you start?"
A very good question, and certainly beyond me at 14. I kind of had to, I tell him. Even then, so young, but so smooth.
"Do you hear a voice?"
he wants to know.
"Something or somebody telling you what to do, and you had to do it?"
I say with 14-year-old eloquence. "Not exactly."
"Tell me," Harry says.
"Oh, for a moon. A good fat moon. Something bigger to look at." I clutch another fistful of pine needles. My face is hot, as if Dad has asked me to talk about sex dreams. Which, in a way, I feel something, I say. Inside. Watching me. Maybe I'm laughing? But not really a voice, just an eloquent teenaged shrug. But it seemed to make sense to Harry.
"And this something, it makes you kill things."
High overhead, a slow, fat jet crawls by. Doesn't make me, I say. Just makes it seem like a good idea.
"Have you ever wanted to kill something else? Something bigger than a dog?"
I try to answer, but there is something in my throat. I clear it. "Yes," I say.
"A person?"
"Nobody in particular, Dad. Just..." I shrug again.
"Why didn't you?"
"It's... I thought you wouldn't like it. You and Mom."
"That's all that stopped you?"
I didn't want you mad at me. Disappointed.
I steal a glance at Harry. He is looking at me, not blinking.
Is that why we took this trip, Dad? To talk about this?
Yes, Harry says. We need to get you squared away.
Squared away? Oh, yes. A completely Harry idea of how life is lived, with hospital corners and polished shoes. And even then, I knew. Needing to kill something every now and then would pretty much sooner or later get in the way of being squared away. How? I say. And he looks at me long and hard, and then he nods when he sees that I am with him step for step.
Good boy, he says. Now. And in spite of saying now, it is a very long time before he speaks again. I watch the lights on a boat as it goes past, maybe 200 yards out from our little beach. Over the sound of their motor, a radio is blasting Cuban music. Now, Harry says again, and I look at him. But he is looking away, across the dying fire, off into the future, over there somewhere. It's like this, he says. I listen carefully. This is what Harry says when he is giving you a higher-order truth. When he showed me how to throw a curveball and how to throw a left hook. It's like this, he would say. And it always was. Just like that. I'm getting old, Dexter. He waited for me to object, but I didn't. And he nodded. I think people understand things different when they get older, he says. It's not a question of getting soft or seeing things in the gray areas instead of black and white. I really believe I'm just understanding things different, better. He looks at me. Harry's look. Tough love with blue eyes. Okay, I say.
10 years ago, I would have wanted you in an institution somewhere, he says.
And I blink. That almost hurts. Except I've thought of it myself.
Now, he says, I think I know better. I know what you are, and I know you're a good kid.
No, I say, and it comes out very soft and weak, but Harry hears.
Yes, he says firmly. You're a good kid, Dex. I know that. I know it.
Almost to himself now, for effect maybe, and then his eyes lock onto mine.
Otherwise, you wouldn't care what I thought, or what Mom thought. You'd just do it. You can't help it, I know that, because...
He stops and just looks at me for a moment. It's very uncomfortable for me.
What do you remember from before?
He asked.
You know, before we took you in.
That still hurts, but I really don't know why. I was only 3. Nothing.
Good, he says. Nobody should remember that.
And as long as he lives, that will be the most he ever says about it.
But even though you don't remember, Dex, it did things to you. Those things make you what you are. I've talked to some people about this.
And strangest of strange, he gives me a very small, almost shy, hairy smile.
I've been expecting this. What happened to you when you were a little kid has shaped you. I've tried to straighten that out, but...
He shrugs.
It was too strong. Too much. It got into you too early, and it's going to stay there. It's going to make you want to kill. And you can't help that. You can't change that. But...
He says, and he looks away again, to see what I can't tell.
But you can channel it. Control it. Choose.
His words come so carefully now, more careful than I've ever heard him talk.
Choose what or who you kill.
And he gave me a smile unlike any I had ever seen before. A smile as bleak and dry as the ashes of our dying fire.
There are plenty of people who deserve it, Dex.
And with those few little words, he gave a shape to my whole life, my everything, my who and what I am. The wonderful, all-seeing, all-knowing man, Harry, my dad. If only I was capable of love, how I would have loved Harry. So long ago now, Harry long dead, but his lessons have lived on. Not because of any warm and gooey emotional feelings I had. Because Harry was right. I'd proved that over and over. Harry knew, and Harry taught me well. "Be careful," Harry said, and he taught me to be careful as only a cop could teach a killer. To choose carefully among those who deserved it. To make absolutely sure. Then tidy up. Leave no traces. And always avoid emotional involvement. It can lead to mistakes. Being careful went beyond the actual killing, of course. Being careful meant building a careful life, too. Compartmentalize, socialize, imitate life. All of which I had done, so very carefully. I was a near-perfect hologram. Above suspicion, beyond reproach, and beneath contempt. A neat and polite monster. The boy next door. Even Deborah was at least half-fooled, half the time. Of course, she believed what she wanted to believe, too. Right now, she believed I could help her solve these murders, jumpstart her career, and catapult her out of her Hollywood sex suit and into a tailored business suit. And she was right, of course. I could help her. But I didn't really want to, because I enjoyed watching this other killer work and felt some kind of aesthetic connection or emotional involvement. Well, there it was. I was in clear violation of the code of Harry. I nosed the boat back toward my canal. It was full dark now, but I steered by a radio tower a few degrees to the left of my home water. So be it. Harry had always been right. He was right now. "Don't get emotionally involved," Harry had said. So I wouldn't. I would help Deb. Chapter 5. The next morning it was raining and the traffic was crazy, like it always is in Miami when it rains. Some drivers slowed down on the slick roads. That made others furious, and they leaned on their horns, screamed out their windows, and accelerated out onto the shoulder, fishtailing wildly past the slowpokes and waving their fists. At the Lejeune on-ramp, a huge dairy truck had roared onto the shoulder and hit a van full of kids from a Catholic school. The dairy truck flipped over, and now 5 young girls in plaid wool skirts were sitting in a huge puddle of milk with dazed looks on their faces. Traffic nearly stopped for an hour. One kid was airlifted to Jackson Hospital. The others sat in the milk in their uniforms and watched the grown-ups scream at each other. I inched along placidly, listening to the radio. Apparently, the police were hot on the trail of the Tamiami Butcher. There were no specifics available, but Captain Matthews got a lovely soundbite. He made it seem like he would personally make the arrest as soon as he finished his coffee. I finally got off onto surface roads and went only a little faster. I stopped at a donut shop not too far from the airport. I bought an apple fritter and a cruller, but the apple fritter was gone almost before I got back into the car. I have a very high metabolism. It comes with living the good life. The rain had stopped by the time I got to work. The sun shone and steam rose from the pavement as I walked into the lobby, flashed my credentials, and went upstairs. Deb was already waiting for me. She didn't look happy this morning. Of course, she doesn't look happy very often anymore. She's a cop, after all, and most of them can't manage the trick at all. Too much time on duty trying not to look human. It leaves their faces stuck. "Deb," I said. I put the crisp white pastry bag on my desk. "Where were you last night?" she said, very sour, as I'd expected. Soon those frown lines would turn permanent, ruining a wonderful face. Deep blue eyes, alive with intelligence, and small upturned nose with just a dash of freckles, framed by black hair. Beautiful features, at the moment spattered with about 7 pounds of cheap makeup. I looked at her with fondness. She was clearly coming from work, dressed today in a lacy bra, bright pink spandex shorts, and gold high heels.
"Never mind me," I said. "Where were you?"
She flushed. She hated to wear anything but clean pressed blues. "I tried to call you," she said.
"Sorry," I said.
"Yeah, sure."
I sat down in my chair and didn't speak. Deb likes to unload on me. That's what family is for.
"Why were you so anxious to talk to me?"
"They're shutting me out," she said. She opened my donut bag and looked inside.
"What did you expect?" I said. "You know how La Guerta feels about you."
She pulled the cruller out of the bag and savaged it.
"I expect," she said, mouthful, "to be in on this,
like the captain said."
"You don't have any seniority," I said, "or any political smarts." She crumpled the bag and threw it at my head. She missed.
"God damn it, Dexter," she said. "You know damned well I deserve to be in homicide. Instead of..."
She snapped her bra strap and waved a hand at her skimpy costume.
"This bullshit."
I nodded. "Although on you it looks good," I said. She made an awful face, rage and disgust competing for space.
"I hate this," she said. "I can't do this much longer, or I swear I'll go nuts."
"It's a little too soon for me to have the whole thing figured out, Deb."
"Shit," she said.
Whatever else you could say about police work, it was ruining Deborah's vocabulary. She gave me a cold, hard cop look, the first I'd ever had from her. It was Harry's look, the same eyes, same feeling of looking right through you to the truth.
"Don't bullshit me, Dex," she said. "All you have to do half the time is see the body, and you know who did it. I never asked you how you do that, but if you have any hunches on this one, I want 'em."
She kicked out savagely and put a small dent in my metal desk.
"God damn it, I want out of this stupid outfit."
"And we'd all love to see that, Morgan,"
came a deep and phony voice from behind her in the doorway. I looked up. Vince Masuoka was smiling in at us.
"You wouldn't know what to do, Vince," Deb told him.
He smiled bigger, that bright, fake textbook smile.
"Why don't we try it and find out?"
"In your dreams, Vince," Debbie said, slumping into a pout that I hadn't seen since she was 12. Vince nodded at the crumpled white bag on my desk.
"It was your turn, Goody. What did you bring me? Where is it?"
"Sorry, Vince," I said. "Debbie ate your cruller."
"I wish," he said, with his sharp imitation leer. "Then I could eat her jelly roll. You owe me a big donut, Dex," he said.
"The only big one you'll ever have," Deborah said.
"It's not the size of the donut, it's the skill of the baker," Vince told her.
"Please," I said, "you two are going to sprain a frontal lobe. It's too early to be this clever."
"Ah-ha," Vince said, with his terrible fake laugh.
"Ah-ha-ha-ha. See you later," he winked.
"Don't forget my donut."
And he wandered away to his microscope down the hall.
"So what have you figured out?" Deb asked me.
Deb believed that every now and then I got hunches. She had reason to believe. Usually my inspired guesses had to do with the brutal wackos who like to hack up some poor slob every few weeks just for the hell of it. Several times Deborah had seen me put a quick and clean finger on something that nobody else knew was there. She had never said anything, but my sister is a damned good cop, and so she has suspected me of something for quite a while. She doesn't know what, but she knows there is something wrong there, and it bothers the hell out of her every now and then, because she does, after all, love me. The last living thing on the earth that does love me. This is not self-pity, but the coldest, clearest self-knowledge. I am unlovable. Following Harry's plan, I have tried to involve myself in other people, in relationships, and even, in my sillier moments, in love. But it doesn't work. Something in me is broken or missing, and sooner or later, the other person catches me acting, or one of those nights comes along. I can't even keep pets. Animals hate me. I bought a dog once. It barked and howled at me in a non-stop no-mind fury for 2 days before I had to get rid of it. I tried a turtle. I touched it once, and it wouldn't come out of its shell again, and after a few days of that, it died. Rather than see me or have me touch it again, it died. Nothing else loves me or ever will. Not even, especially, me. I know what I am, and that is not a thing to love. I am alone in the world. All alone. But for Deborah. Except, of course, for the thing inside, who does not come out to play too often, and does not actually play with me, but must have somebody else. So as much as I can, I care about her, dear Deborah. It is probably not love, but I would rather she were happy. And she sat there, dear Deborah, looking unhappy. My family, staring at me and not knowing what to say, but coming closer to saying it than ever before. Well, I said, actually, I knew it. You do have something. Don't interrupt my trance, Deborah. I'm in touch with the spirit realm. Spit it out, she said. It's the interrupted cut, Deb. The left leg. What about it? LaGuerta thinks the killer was discovered, got nervous, didn't finish. Deborah nodded. She had me asking hookers last night if they saw anything. Somebody must have. Oh, not you too, I said. Think, Deborah. If he was interrupted, too scared to finish. The wrapping, she blurted. He still spent a lot of time wrapping the body, cleaning up. She looked surprised. Shit. After he was interrupted? I clapped my hands and beamed at her. Bravo, Miss Marple. Then it doesn't make sense. Au contraire. If there is plenty of time, but the ritual is not completed properly. And remember, Deb, the ritual is nearly everything. What's the implication? Why can't you just tell me, for God's sake? She snapped. What fun would that be? She blew out a hard breath. God damn it. All right, Dex. If he wasn't interrupted, but he didn't finish. Shit. The wrapping up part was more important than the cutting? I took pity on her. No, Deb. Think. This is the fifth one. Exactly like all the others. Four left legs cut perfectly. And now number five. I shrugged, raised an eyebrow at her. Aw, shit, Dexter. How should I know? Maybe he only needed four left legs. Maybe, I don't know, I swear to God, what? I smiled and shook my head. To me, it was so clear. The thrill is gone, Deb. Something just isn't right. It isn't working. Some essential bit of the magic that makes it perfect isn't there. I was supposed to figure that out? Somebody should, don't you think? And so he just sort of dribbles to a stop, looking for inspiration and finding none. She frowned. So he's done. He won't do this again? I laughed. Oh my God, no, Deb. Just the opposite. If you were a priest and you truly believed in God but couldn't find the right way to worship him, what would you do? Keep trying, she said, until I got it right. She stared hard. Jesus, that's what you think? He's going to do it again soon? It's just a hunch, I said modestly. I could be wrong, but I was sure I was not wrong. We should be setting up a way to catch him when he does, she said, not looking for a non-existent witness. She stood and headed out the door. I'll call later. Bye. And she was gone. I poked at the white paper bag. There was nothing left inside. Just like me. A clean, crisp outside, and nothing at all on the inside. I folded the bag and placed it in the trash can beside my desk. There was work to do this morning. Real official police lab work. I had a long report to type up, accompanying pictures to sort, evidence to file. It was routine stuff. A double homicide that would probably never go to trial. But I like to make sure that whatever I touch is well organized. Besides, this one had been interesting. The blood spatter had been very difficult to read. Between the arterial spurting, the multiple victims, obviously moving around, and the cast-off pattern from what had to be a chainsaw, it had been almost impossible to find an impact site. In order to cover the whole room, I'd had to use two bottles of luminol, which reveals even the faintest of blood spots and is shockingly expensive at $12 a bottle. I'd actually had to lay out strings to help me figure the primary spatter angles, a technique ancient enough to seem like alchemy. The splat patterns were startling, vivid. There were bright, wild, feral splatters across the walls, furniture, television, towels, bedspreads, curtains, an amazing wild horror of flying blood. Even in Miami, you would think someone would have heard something. Two people being hacked up alive with a chainsaw. In an elegant and expensive hotel room, and the neighbors simply turned up their TVs. You may say that dear, diligent Dexter gets carried away in his job, but I like to be thorough, and I like to know where all the blood is hiding. The professional reasons for this are obvious, but not quite as important to me as the personal ones. Perhaps someday a psychiatrist retained by the state penal system will help me discover exactly why. In any case, the body chunks were very cold by the time we got to the scene, and we would probably never find the guy in the size 7.5 handmade Italian loafer, right-handed and overweight, with a terrific backhand. But I had persevered and done a very neat piece of work. I don't do my job to catch the bad guys. Why would I want to do that? No, I do my job to make order out of chaos, to force the nasty bloodstains to behave properly and then go away. Others may use my work to catch criminals. That's fine by me. But it doesn't matter. If I am ever careless enough to be caught, they will say I am a sociopathic monster, a sick and twisted demon who is not even human, and they will probably send me to die in Old Sparky with a smug, self-righteous glow. If they ever catch size 7.5, they will say he is a bad man who went wrong because of social forces he was too unfortunate to resist, and he will go to jail for 10 years before they turn him loose with enough money for a suit and a new chainsaw. Every day at work, I understand Harry a little better. Chapter 6. Friday night. Date night in Miami. And believe it or not, date night for Dexter. Oddly enough, I had found somebody. What? What? Deeply dead Dexter dating debutante Doxies? Sex among the undead? Has my need to imitate life gone all the way to faking orgasms? Breathe easy. Sex never entered into it. After years of dreadful fumbling and embarrassment trying to look normal, I had finally hooked up with the perfect date. Rita was almost as badly damaged as I am. Married too young, she had fought to make it work for 10 years and 2 kids. Her charming life mate had a few small problems. First alcohol, then heroin, believe it or not, and finally crack. He beat her, the brute, broke furniture, screamed and threw things and made threats, then raped her. Infected her with some dreadful crack house diseases. All this on a regular basis, and Rita endured, worked, fought him through rehab twice. Then he went after the kids one night, and Rita finally put her foot down. Her face had healed by now, of course, and broken arms and ribs are routine for Miami physicians. Rita was quite presentable, just what the monster ordered. The divorce was final, the brute was locked up, and then? Ah, the mysteries of the human mind. Somehow, some why, dear Rita had decided to date again. She was quite sure it was the right thing to do. But as a result of her frequent battery at the hands of the man she loved, she was completely uninterested in sex. Just maybe some masculine company for a while. She had searched for just the right guy, sensitive, gentle, and willing to wait. Quite a long search, of course. She was looking for some imaginary man who cared more about having someone to talk to and see movies with than someone to have sex with, because she was just not ready for that. Did I say imaginary? Well, yes. Human men are not like that. Most women know this by the time they've had two kids and their first divorce. Poor Rita had married too young and too badly to learn this valuable lesson. And as a byproduct of recovering from her awful marriage, instead of realizing that all men are beasts, she had come up with this lovely romantic picture of a perfect gentleman who would wait indefinitely for her to open slowly, like a little flower. Well, really, perhaps such a man existed in Victorian England when there was a knocking shop on every corner where he could blow off steam between flowery protestations of frictionless love, but not, to my knowledge, in 21st century Miami. And yet, I could imitate all those things perfectly, and I actually wanted to. I had no interest in a sexual relationship. I wanted a disguise. Rita was exactly what I was looking for. She was, as I say, very presentable. Petite and pert and spunky. A slim athletic figure, short blonde hair and blue eyes. She was a fitness fanatic, spending all her off hours running and biking and so on. In fact, sweating was one of our favorite activities. We had cycled through the Everglades, done 5K runs, and even pumped iron together. And best of all were her two children. Aster was 8, and Cody was 5, and they were much too quiet. They would be, of course. Children whose parents frequently attempt to kill each other with the furniture tend to be slightly withdrawn. Any child brought up in a horror zone is, but they can be brought out of it eventually. Look at me. I had endured nameless and unknown horrors as a child, and yet here I was, a useful citizen, a pillar of the community. Perhaps that was part of my strange liking for Aster and Cody, because I did like them, and that made no sense to me. I know what I am, and I understand many things about myself, but one of the few character traits that genuinely mystifies me is my attitude toward children. I like them. They are important to me. They matter. I don't understand it, really. I genuinely wouldn't care if every human in the universe were suddenly to expire, with the possible exception of myself and maybe Deborah. Other people are less important to me than lawn furniture. I do not, as the shrinks put it so eloquently, have any sense of the reality of others, and I am not burdened with this realization. But kids are different. I had been dating Rita for nearly a year and a half, and in that time I had slowly and deliberately won over Aster and Cody. I was okay. I wouldn't hurt them. I remembered their birthdays, report card days, holidays. I could come into their house and would do no harm. I could be trusted. Ironic, really, but true. Me, the only man they could really trust. Rita thought it was part of my long, slow courtship of her. Show her that the kids liked me, and who knows? But in fact, they mattered to me more than she did. Maybe it was already too late, but I didn't want to see them grow up to be like me. This Friday night, Aster answered the door. She was wearing a large T-shirt that said Rugrats and hung below her knees. Her red hair was pulled back in two pigtails, and she had no expression at all on her small, still face.
"Hello, Dexter,"
she said in her too quiet way. For her, two words were a long conversation.
"Good evening, beautiful young lady,"
I said in my best Lord Mountbatten voice.
"May I observe that you are looking very lovely this evening?"
"Okay," she said, holding the door open. "He's here,"
she said over her shoulder to the darkness around the couch. I stepped past her. Cody was standing behind her, just inside, like he was backing her up, just in case. "Cody," I said. I handed him a roll of Necco wafers. He took them without taking his eyes off me and simply let his hand drop to his side without looking at the candy. He wouldn't open them until I was gone, and then he would split them with his sister.
"Dexter?"
Rita called from the next room.
"In here," I said. "Can't you teach these children to behave?"
"No,"
said Cody softly. A joke. I stared at him. What next? Would he sing someday? Tap dance in the streets? Address the Democratic National Convention? Rita rustled in, fastening a hoop earring. She was rather provocative, considering. She wore a practically weightless light blue silk dress that fell to mid-thigh, and of course her very best New Balance cross-training shoes. I'd never before met, or even heard of, a woman who actually wore comfortable shoes on dates. The enchanting creature.
"Hey, handsome," Rita said. "Let me talk to the sitter and we're out of here."
She went into the kitchen, where I heard her going over instructions with a teenage neighbor who did her babysitting. Bedtimes, homework, TV do's and don'ts, cell phone number, emergency number, what to do in case of accidental poisoning or decapitation. Cody and Aster still stared at me.
"Are you going to a movie?"
Aster asked me. I nodded. "If we can find one that doesn't make us throw up."
"Yuck," she said.
She made a very small, sour face, and I felt a tiny glow of accomplishment.
"Do you throw up at the movies?" Cody asked.
"Cody,"
Aster said.
"Do you?"
he insisted. "No," I said, "but I usually want to."
"Let's go,"
said Rita, sailing in and bending to give each kid a peck on the cheek.
"Listen to Alice. Bedtime at 9. "Will you come back?" Cody asked.
"Cody, of course I'll be back," Rita said.
"I meant Dexter," Cody said.
"You'll be asleep," I said, "but I'll wave at you, okay?"
"I won't be asleep,"
he said grimly.
"Then I'll stop in and play cards with you," I said. "Really?"
"Absolutely. High-stakes poker. Winner gets to keep the horses."
"Dexter," Rita said, smiling anyway. "You'll be asleep, Cody. Now good night, kids. Be good."
And she took my arm and led me out the door.
"Honestly," she murmured, "you've got those two eating out of your hand."
The movie was nothing special. I didn't really want to throw up, but I'd forgotten most of it by the time we stopped at a small place in South Beach for a late-night drink. Rita's idea. In spite of living in Miami for most of her life, she still thought South Beach was glamorous. Perhaps it was all the rollerblades. Or maybe she thought that any place so full of people with bad manners had to be glamorous. In any case, we waited 20 minutes for a small table, and then sat and waited another 20 for service. I didn't mind. I enjoyed watching good-looking idiots looking at each other. A great spectator sport. We strolled along Ocean Boulevard afterward, making pointless conversation, an art at which I excel. It was a lovely night. One corner was chewed off the full moon of a few nights ago, when I had entertained Father Donovan. And as we drove back to Rita's South Miami house after our standard evening out, we passed an intersection in one of Coconut Grove's less wholesome areas. A winking red light caught my eye, and I glanced down the side street. Crime scene. The yellow tape was already up, and several cruisers were nosed into a hurried splay. "It's him again," I thought. And even before I knew what I meant by that, I was swinging the car down the street to the crime scene.
"Where are we going?"
Rita asked, quite reasonably. I said, "I'd like to check here and see if they need me."
"Don't you have a beeper?"
I gave her my best Friday night smile.
"They don't always know they need me," I said.
I might have stopped anyway, to show off Rita. The whole point of wearing a disguise was to be seen wearing her. But in truth, the small, irresistible voice yammering in my ear would have made me stop no matter what.
"It's him again."
And I had to see what he was up to. I left Rita in the car and hurried over. He was up to no good again, the rascal. There was the same stack of neatly wrapped body parts. Angel, no relation, bent over it in almost the same position he'd been in when I left him at the last scene.
"Hijo de puta,"
he said when I approached him. "Not me, I trust," I said. "The rest of us are complaining that we have to work on Friday night," Angel said. "You show up with a date, and there's still nothing for you here." "Same guy? Same pattern?"
"Same,"
he said. He flipped the plastic away with his pen.
"Bone dry again," he said. "No blood at all."
The words made me feel slightly lightheaded. I leaned in for a look. Once again, the body parts were amazingly clean and dry. They had a near blue tinge to them and seemed preserved in their small, perfect moment of time. Wonderful. A small difference in the cuts this time, Angel said. In four places, he pointed. Very rough here, almost emotional. Then here, not so much. Here and here, in between.
Huh?
Very nice, I said.
And then look at this, he said.
He nudged aside the bloodless chunk on top with a pencil. Underneath, another piece gleamed white. The flesh had been flayed off very carefully, lengthwise, to reveal a clean bone.
Why he would do like that?
Angel asked softly. I breathed.
He's experimenting, I said, trying to find the right way.
And I stared at the neat, dry section until I became aware that Angel had been looking at me for a very long moment. Like a kid playing with his food, is how I described it to Rita when I returned to the car.
My God, Rita said, that's horrible.
I think the correct word is heinous, I said.
How can you joke about it, Dexter?
I gave her a reassuring smile. You kind of get used to it in my line of work, I said. We all make jokes to hide our pain.
Well, good Lord, I hope they catch this maniac soon.
I thought of the neatly stacked body parts, the variety of cuts, the wonderful total lack of blood.
Not too soon, I said. What did you say? She asked.
I said, I don't think it will be too soon. The killer is extremely clever, and the detective in charge of the case is more interested in playing politics than in solving murders. She looked at me to see if I was kidding. Then she sat quietly for a while as we drove south on US 1. She didn't speak until South Miami.
I can never get used to seeing, I don't know, the underside? The way things really are?
The way you see it. She finally said. She took me by surprise. I'd been using the silence to think about the nicely stacked body parts we had just left. My mind had been hungrily circling the clean, dry, chopped-up limbs, like an eagle looking for a chunk of meat to rip out. Rita's observation was so unexpected I couldn't even stutter for a minute.
"What do you mean?" I managed to say at last.
She frowned.
I'm not sure. Just, we all assume that things really are a certain way. The way they're supposed to be. And then they never are. They're always more, I don't know, darker? More human? Like this. I'm thinking, of course the detective wants to catch the killer. Isn't that what detectives do? And it never occurred to me before that there could be anything at all political about murder.
Practically everything, I said. I turned onto her street and slowed down in front of her neat and unremarkable house.
But you, she said.
She didn't seem to notice where we were or what I had said.
That's where you start. Most people would never really think it through that far.
I'm not all that deep, Rita, I said. I nudged the car into park.
It's like everything really is two ways, the way we all pretend it is and the way it really is. And you already know that, and it's like a game for you.
I had no idea what she was trying to say. In truth, I had given up trying to figure it out, and as she spoke, I'd let my mind wander back to the newest murder.
The cleanness of the flesh, the improvisational quality of the cuts, the complete, dry, spotless, immaculate lack of blood. Dexter, Rita said.
She put a hand on my arm.
I kissed her.
I don't know which one of us was more surprised. It really wasn't something I had thought about doing ahead of time. And it certainly wasn't her perfume. But I mashed my lips against hers and held them there for a long moment. She pushed away.
No, she said. No, Dexter. All right, I said, still shocked at what I had done. I don't think I want to... I'm not ready for... Damn it, Dexter, she said. She unclipped her seatbelt, opened the car door, and ran into her house. Oh, dear, I thought. What on earth have I done now? And I knew I should be wondering about that, and perhaps feeling disappointed that I had just destroyed my disguise after a year and a half of hard maintenance. But all I could think about was the neat stack of body parts. No blood. None at all. Chapter 7. This body is stretched out just the way I like it. The arms and legs are secure, and the mouth is stopped with duct tape, so there will be no noise and no spill into my work area. And my hands feel so steady with the knife that I am quite sure this will be a good one. Very satisfying. Except it's not a knife. It's some kind of... Except it's not my hand. Even though my hand is moving with this hand, it's not mine that holds the blade. And the room really is sort of small. It's so narrow. Which makes sense because it's... What? And now here I am floating above this perfect, tight workspace, and its tantalizing body, and for the first time I feel the cold blowing around me, and even through me somehow. And if I could only feel my teeth, I am quite sure they would chatter. And my hand, in perfect unison with that other hand, goes up and arches back for a perfect cut. And, of course, I wake up in my apartment, standing somehow by the front door, completely naked. Sleepwalking I could understand, but sleep-stripping? Really? I stumble back to my little trundle bed. The covers are in a heap on the floor. The air conditioner has kicked the temperature down close to 60. It had seemed like a good idea at the time, last night, feeling a little estranged from it all after what had happened with Rita. Preposterous, if it had really happened. Dexter, the love bandit, stealing kisses. And so I had taken a long hot shower when I got home and shoved the thermostat all the way down as I climbed into bed. I don't pretend to understand why, but in my darker moments, I find cold cleansing. Not refreshing so much as necessary. And cold it was, far too cold now, for coffee and the start of the day amid the last tattered pieces of the dream. As a rule, I don't remember my dreams, and don't attach any importance to them if I do. So it was ridiculous that this one was staying with me. Floating above this perfect, tight workspace, my hand in perfect unison with that other hand goes up and arches back for a perfect cut. I've read the books. Perhaps because I'll never be one, humans are interesting to me. So I know all the symbolism. Floating is a form of flying, meaning sex, and the knife. Ja, Herr Doctor, the knife is dein mother, ja? Snap out of it, Dexter. Just a stupid, meaningless dream. The telephone rang, and I almost jumped out of my skin. How about breakfast at Wolfie's? Said Deborah. My treat. It's Saturday morning, I said. We'll never get in. I'll get there first and get a table, she said. Meet you there. Wolfie's Deli on Miami Beach was a Miami tradition, and because the Morgans are a Miami family, we'd been eating there all our lives on those special deli occasions. Why Deborah thought today might be one of those occasions was beyond me, but I was sure she would enlighten me in time. So I took a shower, dressed in my casual Saturday best, and drove out to the beach. Traffic was light over the new improved MacArthur Causeway, and soon I was politely elbowing my way through the teeming throngs at Wolfie's. True to her word, Deborah had corralled a corner table. She was chatting with an ancient waitress, a woman even I recognized. Rose, my love, I said, bending to kiss her wrinkled cheek. She turned her permanent scowl on me. My wild Irish Rose. Dexter, she rasped, with her thick Middle European accent.
Knock off with the kiss like some fagala.
Fagala? Is that Irish for fiancé? I asked her, and slid into my chair.
Feh,
she said, trudging off to the kitchen and shaking her head at me. I think she likes me, I told Deborah.
Somebody should, said Deb.
How was your date last night?
A lot of fun, I said. You should try it sometime.
Feh, said Deborah.
You can't spend all your nights standing on Tamiami Trail in your underwear, Deb. You need a life.
I need a transfer, she snarled at me. To Homicide Bureau. Then we'll see about a life.
I understand, I said. It would certainly sound better for the kids to say Mommy's in homicide.
Dexter, for Christ's sake, she said.
It's a natural thought, Deborah. Nephews and nieces. More little Morgans.
Why not?
She blew out a long breath.
I thought Mom was dead, she said.
I'm channeling her, I said, through the cherry Danish.
Well, change the channel. What do you know about cell crystallization?
I blinked. Wow, I said. You just blew away all the competition in the subject-changing tournament.
I'm serious, she said.
Then I really am floored, Deb.
What do you mean, cell crystallization? From cold, she said. Cells that have crystallized from cold.
Light flooded my brain.
Of course, I said. Beautiful.
And somewhere, deep inside, small bells began to ring.
Cold. Clean, pure cold, and the cool knife almost sizzling as it slices into the warm flesh. Antiseptic, clean coldness. The blood slowed and helpless. So absolutely right and totally necessary. Cold.
Why didn't I started to say. I shut up when I saw Deborah's face.
What?
Deb demanded.
What, of course?
I shook my head. First, tell me why you want to know. She looked at me for a long, hard moment and blew out another breath.
I think you know, she said at last. There's been another murder.
I know, I said. I passed it last night.
I heard you didn't actually pass it.
I shrugged. Metro Dade is such a small family.
So what did that, of course, mean?
Nothing, I said, mildly irritated at last.
The flesh of the body just looked a little different. If it was subjected to cold,
I held up my hands.
That's all, okay? How cold? Like meatpacking cold, she said. Why would he do that?
Because it's beautiful, I thought. It would slow the flow of blood, I said.
She studied me. Is that important?
I took a long and perhaps slightly shaky breath. Not only could I never explain it, she would lock me up if I tried.
It's vital, I said.
For some reason, I felt embarrassed.
Why vital?
I don't know. I think he has a thing about blood, Deb. Just a feeling I got from, I don't know, no evidence, you know. She was giving me that look again. I tried to think of something to say, but I couldn't. Glib, silver-tongued Dexter, with a dry mouth and nothing to say.
Shit, she said at last. That's it? Cold slows the blood, and that's vital? Come on. What the hell good is that, Dexter?
I don't do good before coffee, Deborah, I said with a heroic effort at recovery.
Just accurate. Shit,
she said again. Rose brought our coffee. Deborah sipped.
Last night I got an invite to the 72-hour briefing, she said.
I clapped my hands. Wonderful, you've arrived. What do you need me for? Metro Dade has a policy of pulling the homicide team together approximately 72 hours after a murder. The investigating officer and her team talk it over with the medical examiner and, sometimes, someone from the prosecutor's office. It keeps everyone on the same heading. If Deborah had been invited, she was on the case. She scowled.
I'm not good at politics, Dexter. I can feel LaGuerta pushing me out, but I can't do anything about it.
Is she still looking for her mystery witness? Deborah nodded. Really? Even after the new kill last night?
She says that proves it, because the new cuts were all complete.
But they were all different, I protested.
She shrugged. And you suggested... Deb looked away.
I told her I thought it was a waste of time to look for a witness when it was obvious that the killer wasn't interrupted, just unsatisfied.
Ouch, I said. You really don't know anything about politics.
Well, goddammit, Dex, she said.
Two old ladies at the next table glared at her. She didn't notice.
What you said made sense. It is obvious, and she's ignoring me. And even worse.
What could be worse than being ignored? I said.
She blushed. I caught a couple of the uniforms snickering at me afterward. There's a joke going around, and I'm it.
She bit her lip and looked away.
Einstein, she said.
I'm afraid I don't get it.
If my tits were brains, I'd be Einstein, she said bitterly.
I cleared my throat instead of laughing.
That's what she's spreading about me, Deb went on. That kind of crappy little tag sticks to you, and then they don't promote you because they think nobody will respect you with a nickname like that. God damn it, Dex, she said again. She's ruining my career.
I felt a little surge of protective warmth.
She's an idiot. Should I tell her that, Dex? Would that be political?
Our food arrived. Rose slammed the plates down in front of us as though she had been condemned by a corrupt judge to serve breakfast to baby killers. I gave her a gigantic smile, and she trudged away, muttering to herself. I took a bite and turned my thoughts to Deborah's problem. I had to try to think of it that way, Deborah's problem. Not those fascinating murders, not that amazingly attractive M.O., or the thing so similar to what I would love to do someday. I had to stay uninvolved, but this was pulling at me so very hard. Even last night's dream, with its cold air. Pure coincidence, of course, but unsettling anyway. This killer had touched the heart of what my killing was about. In the way he worked, of course, and not in his selection of victims. He had to be stopped, certainly, no question. Those poor hookers. Still, the need for cold. So very interesting to explore sometime. Find a nice, dark, narrow place. Narrow? Where had that come from? My dream, naturally. But that was just saying that my unconscious wanted me to think about it, wasn't it? And narrow felt right somehow. Cold and narrow. Refrigerated truck, I said. I opened my eyes. Deborah struggled mightily with a mouthful of eggs before she could speak.
What?
Oh, just a guess. Not a real insight, I'm afraid. But wouldn't it make sense?
Wouldn't what make sense? She asked.
I looked down at my plate and frowned, trying to picture how this would work. He wants a cold environment to slow the blood flow. And because it's, cleaner.
If you say so.
I do say so. And it has to be a narrow space.
Why? Where the hell did that come from? Narrow.
I chose not to hear that question. So a refrigerated truck would fit those conditions. And it's mobile, which makes it much easier to dump the garbage afterward. Deborah took a bite of bagel and thought for a moment while she chewed.
So, she said at last, and swallowed. The killer might have access to one of these trucks, or own one?
Maybe. Except the kill last night was the first that showed signs of cold.
Deborah frowned.
So he went out and bought a truck?
Probably not. This is still experimental. It was probably an impulse to try cold.
She nodded. And we would never get lucky enough that he drives one for a living or something, right? I gave her my happy shark smile.
Ah, Deb, how quick you are this morning.
No, I'm afraid our friend is much too smart to connect himself that way.
Deborah sipped her coffee, put the cup down, and leaned back.
So we're looking for a stolen refrigerator truck, she said at last.
I'm afraid so, I said. But how many of those can there be in the last 48 hours?
In Miami? She snorted. Somebody steals one, word gets out that it's worth stealing, and suddenly every goddamn two-bit original gangster, Marilito, crackhead, and junior wise guy has to steal one, just to keep up. Let's hope word isn't out yet, I said. Deborah swallowed the last of her bagel. I'll check, she said. And then she reached across the table and squeezed my hand. I really appreciate this, she said. She gave me a couple of seconds of a shy, hesitant smile. But I worry about how you come up with this stuff, Dex. I just... She looked down at the table and squeezed my hand again. I squeezed back. Leave the worrying to me, I said. You just find that truck. Chapter 8. In theory, Metro's 72-hour meeting gives everyone enough time to get somewhere with a case, but is soon enough that the leads are still warm. And so Monday morning, in a conference room on the second floor, the crack crime-fighting team led by the indomitable Detective LaGuerta assembled once again for the 72-hour. I assembled with them. I got some looks and a few good-hearted remarks from the cops who knew me. Just simple, cheerful wit like, "Hey, blood boy, where's your squeegee?" Salt of the earth, these people. And soon my Deborah would be one of them. I felt proud and humble to be in the same room. Unfortunately, these feelings were not shared by all present. "The fuck you doing here?" grunted Sergeant Doakes. He was a very large black man with an injured air of permanent hostility. He had a cold ferocity to him that would certainly come in handy for somebody with my hobby. It was a shame we couldn't be friends. But for some reason, he hated all lab techs, and for some additional reason, that had always meant especially Dexter. He also held the Metro Dade record for the bench press, so he rated my political smile. "I just dropped in to listen, Sergeant," I told him. "Got no fucking call to be here," he said. "The fuck out of here."
"He can stay, Sergeant," LaGuerta said.
Doakes scowled at her. "The fuck for?" "I don't want to make anybody unhappy," I said, edging for the door without any real conviction.
"It's perfectly all right," LaGuerta said, with an actual smile for me.
She turned to Doakes.
"He can stay," she repeated.
"Give me the fucking creeps," Doakes grumbled.
I began to appreciate the man's finer qualities.
Of course I gave him the fucking creeps.
The only real question was why he was the only one in a room filled with cops who had the insight to get the fucking creeps from my presence.
"Let's get started," LaGuerta said, cracking her whip gently, leaving no room for doubt that she was in charge.
Doakes slouched back in his chair with a last scowl at me. The first part of the meeting was a matter of routine. Reports, political maneuvers, all the little things that make us human. Those of us who are human, anyway. LaGuerta briefed the information officers on what they could and could not release to the press. Things they could release included a new glossy photo of LaGuerta she'd made up for the occasion. It was serious and yet glamorous, intense but refined. You could almost see her making lieutenant in that picture. If only Deborah had that kind of PR smarts. It took most of an hour before we got around to the actual murders. But finally, LaGuerta asked for reports on the progress in finding her mystery witness. Nobody had anything to report. I tried hard to look surprised. LaGuerta gave the group a frown of command. "Come on, people," she said. "Somebody needs to find something here." But nobody did, and there was a pause while the group studied their fingernails, the floor, the acoustic tiles in the ceiling. Deborah cleared her throat.
I she said and cleared her throat again. "I had an idea. A different idea. About trying something in a slightly different direction." She said it like it was in quotation marks, and indeed it was. All my careful coaching couldn't make her sound natural when she said it, but she had at least stuck to my carefully worded, politically correct phrasing. LaGuerta raised an artificially perfect eyebrow.
"An idea, really?"
She made a face to show how surprised and delighted she was. "Please, by all means, share it with us, Officer Officer Morgan." Doakes snickered. A delightful man. Deborah flushed, but slogged on. The cell crystallization on the last victim. I'd like to check and see if any refrigerated trucks have been reported stolen in the last week or so. Silence. Utter, dumb silence. The silence of the cows. They didn't get it, the brickheads, and Deborah was not making them see it. She let the silence grow, a silence LaGuerta milked with a pretty frown, a puzzled glance around the room to see if anybody else was following this, then a polite look at Deborah. "Refrigerated trucks," LaGuerta said. Deborah looked completely flustered, the poor child. This was not a girl who enjoyed public speaking. "That's right," she said. LaGuerta let it hang, enjoying it. "Mm-hmm," she said. Deborah's face darkened. Not a good sign. I cleared my throat, and when that didn't do any good, I coughed, loud enough to remind her to stay cool. She looked at me. So did LaGuerta. "Sorry," I said. "I think I'm getting a cold." Could anyone really ask for a better brother? The cold, Deborah blurted, lunging at my lifeline. "A refrigerated vehicle could probably cause that kind of tissue damage. And it's mobile, so he'd be harder to catch. And getting rid of the body would be a lot easier. So, if one was stolen, I mean a truck, a refrigerated, that might give us a lead." Well, that was most of it, and she did get it out there. One or two thoughtful frowns blossomed around the room. I could almost hear gears turning. But LaGuerta just nodded. "That's a very interesting thought, officer," she said. She put just the smallest emphasis on the word officer, to remind us all that this was a democracy where anybody could speak up, but really... "But I still believe that our best bet is to find the witness. We know he's out there." She smiled a politically shy smile. "Or she," she said, to show that she could be sharp. "But somebody saw something. We know that from the evidence. So let's concentrate on that and leave grasping at straws for the guys in Broward, okay?" She paused, waiting for a little chuckle to run around the room. "But, Officer Morgan, I would appreciate your continued help talking to the hookers. They know you down there." My God, she was good. She had deflected anyone from possibly thinking about Deb's idea, put Deb in her place, and brought the team back together behind her with the joke about our rivalry with Broward County. All in a few simple words. I felt like applauding. Except, of course, that I was on poor Deborah's team, and she had just been flattened. Her mouth opened for a moment, then closed, and I watched her jaw muscles knot as she carefully pushed her face back into cop neutral. In its own way, a fine performance, but truly not even in the same league as LaGuerta's. The rest of the meeting was uneventful. There was really nothing to talk about beyond what had been said. So very shortly after LaGuerta's masterful put-down, the meeting broke up and we were in the hall again. "Damn her," Deborah muttered under her breath. Damn her." "Absolutely," I agreed. She glared at me. "Thanks, bro. Some help you were." I raised my eyebrows at her. "But we agreed I would stay out of it, so you would get the credit." She snarled. "Some credit. She made me look like an idiot." "With absolute respect, sister dear, you met her halfway." Deborah looked at me, looked away, threw up her hands with disgust. "What was I supposed to say? I'm not even on the team. I'm just there because the captain said they had to let me in."
"And he didn't say they had to listen to you," I said.
"And they don't. And they won't," Deborah said bitterly. "Instead of getting me into homicide, this is going to kill my career. I'll die a meter maid, Dexter."
"There is a way out, Deb," I said. And the look she turned on me now was only about one-third hope.
"What?" she said.
I smiled at her,
my most comforting, challenging, I'm not really a shark smile.
Find the truck, I said.
It was 3 days before I heard from my dear foster sister again, a longish period for her to go without talking to me. She came into my office just after lunch on Thursday, looking sour. I found it, she said, and I didn't know what she meant.
Found what, Deb? I asked. The fountain of grumpiness?
The truck, she said. The refrigerated truck. But that's great news, I said.
Why do you look like you're searching for somebody to slap?
Because I am, she said, and flung 4 or 5 stapled pages onto my desk. Look at this.
I picked it up and glanced at the top page.
Oh, I said.
How many altogether?
23, she said. In the last month, 23 refrigerated trucks have been reported stolen. The guys over on traffic say most of them turn up in canals, torched for the insurance money. Nobody pushes too hard to find them, so nobody's been pushing on these, and nobody's going to.
Welcome to Miami, I said.
Deborah sighed and took the list back for me, slouching into my extra chair like she'd just lost all her bones. There's no way I can check them all, not by myself. It would take months. God damn it, Dex, she said. Now what do we do?
I shook my head. I'm sorry, Deb, I said, but now we have to wait.
That's it? Just wait?
That's it, I said. And it was. For 2 more weeks, that was it. We waited. And then...
This ends Disc 2.